I do want to mention this. I didn't say it before. Today is brunch, so it's a time that we have every last Sunday of every month where we stay together after the worship service to have a time of fellowship with each other. There's always lots of good food, so if you're here visiting, or and there may be someone sitting here today saying, well, I didn't bring anything, don't worry about that one bit. That doesn't make any difference. Please stay and be a part of it. We'd love to have you. Okay, well, we're jumping into 2 Corinthians again this morning. We're in chapter 11, and just remember what we talked about last week, that as well as things had gone in Corinth in more recent times, from Paul's perspective, there still remain people there who were critical of him, people actually that we found out last week were claiming to be apostles themselves, and they were discouraging the people from listening to what Paul had told them and even acknowledging his apostleship and accepting that. So this is where we're going to pick up this morning. This is chapter 11, verse 16 to the end of the chapter. Again, I say, let no one think me foolish, but if you do, receive me as even as foolish, that I also may boast a little. That which I am speaking, I'm not speaking as the Lord would, but as in foolishness, in this confidence of boasting. Since many boast according to the flesh, I will boast also. For you, being so wise, bear with the foolish gladly. For you bear with anyone if he enslaves you, if he devours you, if he takes advantage of you, if he exalts himself, and if he hits you in the face. To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison. But in whatever respect anyone else is bold, I speak in foolishness. I am just as bold myself. Are the Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so. In far more labors and far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. Apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches, who is weak without my being weak, who is led into sin without my intense concern. If I have to boast, I will boast of what pertains to my weakness. The Lord of the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, or Jesus, he who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the ethnarch under Ariatus, the king, was guarding the city of the Damascenes in order to seize me, and I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and so escaped his hands. Well, again, remembering last week that basically what Paul has entered into in this part of the letter is what some people would acknowledge as being boasting on his part, and he acknowledges that in some degree that is what's going on. But one of the things we're going to find today is that his boasting is very different than you're going to find the boasting of people normally to be. He doesn't boast in his accomplishments and the things that he's done great in life for the honors that have been bestowed upon him or anything along those lines. When Paul boasts, he boasts in his weakness, in his great sufferings, as we've read this morning. You've heard me say over the last few weeks that it's quite likely true that there's no one that has suffered for the cross more than the Apostle Paul, except for the Lord Jesus. Great sufferings. He's been put in a position now where he really has no other option but to do a little boasting on his own. to put basically those false apostles in their place. Because evidently they have gained some following in Corinth. There are people that are listening to what they're saying and they're following after what they've heard them say, which in essence means turning away from Paul, which even greater than that means turning away from Jesus. It means accepting a lie for the truth. It means accepting another gospel that really is not the gospel. It means accepting another spirit. It means accepting a different Jesus than the Jesus we find in the Bible. Remember, Paul is a spiritual father of the church in Corinth. The many people that he's writing to are people that came to faith through his ministry, either directly or indirectly. He bears responsibility for them, not because he has to, not because he just looks upon this as a duty that he performs, but understanding that they indeed are his spiritual children, and he loves them, and he is willing to do whatever is necessary for him to do as their spiritual father to keep them on track. Just remember that Paul was a great lion when he was persecuting the church. If you'd asked the person on the street in those days who was of all was persecuting those people of the way to the greatest extent, most people would have echoed the name of the apostle Paul, but not an apostle then, but as the Pharisee Paul. That we know that just as his fervor was so great as an unbeliever to snuff out Christianity, his fervor for Christianity as a believer has become as great, if not greater. He was one of the greatest defenders of the faith of all time. Probably ground from the Bible to say something like this, that his fervor, his desire and passion for the furtherment of the gospel may have even been greater than that of the Apostle Peter and the Apostle John. This is a man who was consumed, literally consumed with Jesus. He slept Jesus. He talked Jesus. Everything he did was about Jesus. We need to be careful to understand here that he's not jealous. He's not doing what he's doing out of jealousy. It's not one of those things where, you know, you have this group of people that are the students of a particular teacher, and he's that teacher, and now someone else comes along, another teacher comes along, and begins to steal students away from him. This is not what's going on with the Apostle Paul at all. He's not jealous because of what is taking place in Corinth. We know this for a lot of reasons. And one of those is it was a guy named Apollos who came into Corinth after Paul left. And he began to preach and teach the gospel. Paul actually endorses what Apollos did. Paul was all for Apollos. He says this of him, "I planted Apollos water, but God was causing the growth. So then neither the one plants nor the one who waters is anything but God who causes the growth." He saw Apollos coming on his heels as being a great gift from God to the people in Corinth. So we need to understand that the things going on now with Paul have nothing to do with jealousy. He's not jealous of these false apostles. What he writes will appear to be foolish to some. He's boasting, and he understands that, but he's boasting for one reason, and that's because he's been given no other choice but to defend himself through what sounds like boasting. Again, remember that Paul was humble among men. We've seen that even the false apostles acknowledged that that when he was present in person, that he was a humble person. Paul was among many things, but he was a fool for Jesus. He was crazy for Jesus, if you want to put it that way. He's been a believer now for many years. He's walked many roads. He's preached many sermons. He's met lots of people. He's seen many, many people come to faith in Jesus Christ. As a young convert, he was not welcomed by the church. If it wasn't for Barnabas, you'd have to wonder where Paul would have wound up, because Barnabas really befriended Paul when no one else was willing to do that. And we can understand it from a human perspective. We would be suspicious of this great persecutor of the church who all of a sudden becomes a believer. We would doubt their sincerity. We would not open our arms up and welcome them into the family of God. But there was a guy named Barnabas who did that with Paul. And I would imagine Barnabas, that happening had a lot to do with his advancement in the ministry. Have you ever wondered what... Paul was looked upon with great suspicion by the church, but what about his Pharisaic pals? How would they look upon what Paul had done? He would have been known as a turncoat. They would be looking at him and saying, "You fool, how could you possibly believe in that hogwash? You're turning away from God by doing what you're doing." The last person we thought would ever be converted to Christianity was you, Paul. And look what you've done. Many of you know my own testimony. Spent a good bit of my adult life as an unbeliever. Not that I wasn't church, because I grew up in the church just to a very loose degree. But the Lord began to work in me, and one of the things I had struggled with was the idea of hypocrisy, because I'll be honest with you, mostly what I had seen from the church was hypocrisy, and that's one of the reasons I gave up on it, was because I saw a bunch of people saying, "You need to do that," and they were doing this. I'm not sure I ever met many people. I'm sure there were some. Met many people who were really living for Christ. They talked a lot about Jesus, but as far as living for Christ, that seemed to be something that was very elusive to me. Until one Sunday. I started going to church, and it wasn't because I was a believer. I started going to church because I just had, God had churned up my curiosity, and I wanted to learn more. And so I decided to start going to church. The very first Sunday I was at church, there was a missionary that came. His name was Alan Lee. And he preached that day, and he not only preached that day, he was also there for a reason, and the reason was he was trying to raise support and actually to get people to volunteer to come to Uganda, where he was a missionary, that summer to be involved in a building construction project. But as he preached, I began to look at him and look at his life, and it began to dawn on me that either this man was an absolute lunatic, he had lost his mind to do what he was doing, because he and his family had sold everything they had. All of their worldly possessions could have been put into a little tiny, teeny, tiny box at that point. So they could go and live in a place like Africa, in Uganda, where there was still a civil war going on there in certain places. And he was willing to subject his family, because it wasn't just him going, it was his wife and their kids who went. That Alan Lee, he and his wife Sally, they buried one of their children. Not because of Uganda necessarily, but by the time we got there, we found out that one of their sons, Benjamin, had been diagnosed with muscular dystrophy. And the prognosis was not good. And lo and behold, after a few years after that, he died. He passed away. One of the sweetest kids I think I've ever met in my whole lifetime. But I came to understand something when I was listening to him talk that day, and that is either this, he is a fool. He's an absolute lunatic. He's insane. There's something wrong with him. Or he knows something I just don't know. Or he knows someone that I just don't know. Let me tell you guys, that impacted me like nothing else had up to that. It was like a cannonball. Because I finally found that person who was willing to do what Christians talked about doing all the time and didn't ever seem to do. He was sold out to this fellow named Jesus Christ wholeheartedly. He gave up everything around him that so many people would put value in to go to share the gospel with people he didn't even know. He was either a lunatic or he made more sense than anyone else I had ever met. You see, sometimes, guys, our lives, looking at them from the outside on the behalf of believers, should look very foolish. Should look like we're a bunch of crazy people. But you know what? Sometimes what we do ought to even amaze our brothers and sisters in Christ. Should appear, in some sense, to be foolish, even to believers at times. Many of you know that we have a debt-free policy here at Springs, and we've always had a debt-free policy at Springs, even when we had 10 people. And we've seen God bless our church in just great ways, in all kinds of ways, but this is one of them, and that is we've never been short of money. He's blessed us. But let me tell you, when I began to share with pastor friends of mine that we were going to have a debt-free ministry, they thought I had lost my mind. You're crazy. That will never happen. I heard that from some of my very best friends. That will never happen. You are going to cripple your ministry by taking that approach to it. Well, after years of not just getting by, but doing very well, and then we built a building and everything that went along with that, it didn't look so crazy anymore. We need to be fools for Jesus. Let me tell you, the church needs many, many things today, but one of the things it needs more than anything else is people who are fools for Jesus, who are consumed with Christ, who are willing to go out on the limb that no one else is willing to go out on. Michael and Cindy Erb. Let me tell you, there's some things I've heard as a pastor that I never wanted to hear. One of them was the day that Cindy and Michael stopped me in the hall and they said, "We're going to Honduras." How many people looked at what they were doing as being somewhat foolish, somewhat crazy? How many people right now are saying, because we know that things there are not so good right now security-wise, how foolish they are for not packing everything up and coming home? They're an example to us of what it means to be sold out to Jesus, to do, because I can tell you right now, Michael and Cindy, above everything else, they're sensitive to us, they love us, but more than anything else, they want to do what God wants them to do, regardless of what it costs them. To us, it looks a little bit foolish. To them, it makes perfect sense. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I more so. Evidently, these false apostles are claiming to have an impeccable pedigree. In other words, because of their background, because of their education, they're claiming that they've been given great authority and great power and great everything else, and that they basically were fine-tuned and picked to hold those particular positions. Their credentials are impeccable. Well, but we know this, and we've seen this in other places, and that is, as far as impeccable pedigree goes, there was no one like the Apostle Paul. He was very well prepared, very well trained, educated, very well, as far as his descendancy goes, to be what he was, to be that Pharisee above Pharisees. He knows that none of his opposition can hold a candle to his pedigree as far as his qualifications. Philippians chapter 3, verse 4 through 6, he says this, "If anyone else has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more circumcised on the eighth day of the nation of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law of Pharisee, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law found blameless." Paul had every reason, had every ground to boast from that perspective, but he refuses to do that. Few people would use the approach that Paul's about to turn to. Because when people boast, they don't boast about the sufferings that they've endured. What they very often boast about is what they've accomplished. For instance, some people might expect Paul at this point to say something like this, "This is my qualification. I planted more churches than anybody else. I've traveled far more places than anybody else. I've won more converts than anybody else. I've written more letters, books, than anybody else. I've preached more sermons than anybody else. I raised more money than anybody else. I've done this, that, and the other more than anybody else." He could have done that. I just randomly, when I was in my office this day, just pick up a book, and because all I wanted to do is look at the jackets to see what they had to say about the authors. And this particular one was written by a guy named Richard Dawkins, who's an atheist. Yes, I do read atheistic books. Not because I believe them, but because it helps me understand where people are coming from better. "The Greatest Show on Earth." But this is what it says. "Richard Dawkins is the author of the blockbuster bestseller, The Delusion of God, or The God Delusion. He was first catapulted to fame with The Selfish Gene, which he followed with The Extended Phenotype and 6 other books. Dawkins is a fellow of both the Royal Society and the Royal Society of Literature. He is a recipient of numerous honors and awards, including the Royal Society of Literature Award, the Shakespeare Prize, the Lewis Prize for Writing About Science, the Galaxy British Book Award Author of the Year Award, the International Cosmos Prize of Japan, etc., etc., etc. Very good credentials, right? Paul could have beat that very easily. He chose not to do that. He didn't talk about his accomplishments. Did Paul have accomplishments at this point? Probably far more than anyone else. But he decided not to boast in those, not to use the normal approach that sinful people would do. He boasts about his sufferings. He boasts about his trials and tribulations, all of those things that he has endured for the benefit of the gospel. Now, I'm not going to go into these in detail because we could spend the next 2 weeks picking every one of these things apart a little bit. But what we need to understand here is that every one of these brought personal suffering upon Paul. It may have been physical, it may have been mental, it may have been emotional. But he suffered. And I'm talking about real suffering. It's not that he got scourged and it didn't hurt. God fixed it so it didn't hurt Paul. He endured it. One of the most painful things, one of the most painful tortures anyone could be submitted to, and not just once, many times. I hope you understand something here, that Paul is just giving a snapshot of some examples of things that he has endured. His list is not an exhaustive list. More than likely, he could have added lots of other things to it. He's only giving examples of sufferings that he's endured for the gospel, as if to say to those false prophets, "Now where do you stand? Now how do you look? What is it that you can claim that you suffered for the gospel that you're preaching, which is not a gospel, for the Jesus you're teaching, who is not the real Jesus?" When I was in middle school, there was a kid that I knew something of. I'm not going to mention his name because some of you may actually be familiar with it. But I didn't know him. But I heard the story about him. A short time before that, his parents had a house on one of the lakes around Ocala. And he and his family were there one day, and some of the kids had taken their power boat, and they were driving around the lake, and this particular kid was on an inner tube, and he decided to paddle out. Well, the boat ran him over. He was run over by a power boat with an outboard motor. He survived. He nearly bled to death. But he did survive. My brother had gym class with him. And you know, when they would come in with their street clothes and everybody would get dressed, he saw this particular boy with his shirt off one day. And he was aghast at the scars, how many there were, and how big they were. Difficult time for him, a difficult time for his family, because it was a teenage girl that they all knew and loved who was driving the boat. Those who doubted Paul, if they saw him one time with his shirt off, their mouth would have been shut permanently. He bore the bodily scars for teaching the gospel. He also bore the weight of constant concern for the churches. We talked about this at times. Can you imagine what the Apostle Paul's prayer list looked like? I would imagine Paul spent hour upon hour, every day praying. Martin Luther, they say that he prayed at least 3 hours a day, and if he didn't pray for 3 hours, he felt like he wasted the whole day. And he did it before he did anything else. Can you imagine what Paul's prayer life, what Paul's prayer list was like? Great concerns for many, many people. He knew what it was like to have responsible leader, to be a responsible leader over people in the context of the church, realizing that each one of them is a child of God. Each one of them is a sheep of the Good Shepherd. Realizing that every one of them needs Jesus as much of them as they can have of him. Sleepless nights. Can you imagine that Paul was anxious enough that he had sleepless nights sometimes? The amazing thing to us would be the idea that he ever slept hardly at all, because there were so many people that he was engaged with in a spiritual sense. Discipling them, shepherding them, many times up close and personal, many times from afar through letters. Paul knew what it was like to suffer in every way for Christ. He did it willingly. I want you to think for a minute about your own pedigree. Were you a likely candidate to become a child of the living God? Righteous among men in your day, were you? Better looking than everybody else? The truth is this, is we think that we have not the pedigree at all to be a child of God. and we of ourselves don't. Not even a likely candidate among us, not one. Born into the world, of the world, corrupted and corrupting. But then Jesus places mantle upon us. And now we do have that perfect pedigree. God's chosen people, servants of Christ. Paul, we know, abhors boasting of any form. But if he boasts, he boasts not in his own accomplishments, but he boasts in his suffering. He knows this is true. He knows that if anything at all good has come out of any of it, it has been because of God, not because of Paul. God deserves all the credit. Paul deserves absolutely none. Paul knew something. He knew this. He knew that his major job in life was to shine the spotlight on Jesus, not on Paul. Sometimes, however, it meant Paul being in the limelight, even though I would imagine Paul was one of these people that if he had a choice, he would rather been in the very background watching what other people were doing, not the person who was always up front. He mentions a pertinent event as he begins to close this whole thing that took place in Damascus. Now, when I say Paul and I say Damascus, what do you think of? I hope you think of his conversion that took place on the road to Damascus, because Paul's talking about an event here that happened right after that. Just remember, as he was confronted with Jesus, and Jesus said to him, "Why are you persecuting me?" And it didn't take Paul long, because he was a pretty smart guy, to figure out, Jesus is talking to me. This must mean that guy that I've been telling everybody hasn't been resurrected from dead is in fact living. I've been persecuting people. I've been putting people in prison and clapping my hands, and they are executed. Because they go around teaching and believing the silliness of this gospel of Jesus Christ. Remember, he was blinded that day and had to be led into Damascus, and they took him to a guy named Ananias, who God had already spoken to. And among other things, Ananias was able to heal Paul. The scales fell from his eyes, and he could see once again. What we're told is immediately after that, Paul began to run around Damascus. And what was he doing? He was going to all the synagogues. And guess what he was doing in the synagogues? He was preaching Jesus in the synagogues. Made him very unpopular. So much so, and this is, just remember this, this is immediately after he became a believer. Days. The Jews plotted to have him murdered because he had caused such a ruckus. Paul was consumed with Christ. Acts chapter 9, verse 25, "But their plot became known, and his disciples took him by night and led him down through an opening in the wall, lowering him down in a large basket." So we know exactly what he's talking about here. We know a particular event that he's talking about when he talks about Damascus and this being lowered down. It's really kind of strange. You wonder why in the world he added this little tidbit on here. It's like he said everything he could say already, and then you get along and it's like, oh, by the way, there was this time in Damascus. But why was that important? How did that add to what he's already said? What it meant was this, is you need to understand something. I've endured all those things that have been listed, but guess what? It started with me immediately. on the heels of my conversion. This is the road that I have walked every day of my Christian life. A day of severe suffering, in a sense. It began at the very beginning. It's been ongoing now for years. 5, 10 or more years. He stands as an example of someone that came to understand the place of suffering in the life of a believer very early on. He stands as an example of someone who understood what it was very early on, who did not give up the ghost. Do you think as a brand new believer he might have been tempted at that point to say, you know what, maybe I should be a little less zealous. Maybe I should be a little less impassioned because I'm upsetting people to the point that they want to murder me for what I'm saying. Maybe I need to back off a little bit. Maybe I need to slow down. Maybe I need to sit and just look and watch for a while and keep my big mouth shut. If this is what being a Christian is really like, maybe I should rethink things. As we sit here today, there are some particular teachings that are very popular in the church today. They go by the name of prosperity doctrine. I don't know if you've ever heard anything about it or not, but let me tell you, if you hear anything like this, you run from it like a scalded dog because it is so unbiblical, it's not funny. It's the idea that Jesus wants you to have everything that your little heart desires. Everything from security in life all the way to that big new fancy car you've been looking at. It's the idea that if you want those things, the only thing you have to do is ask God for those, and if your faith is strong enough, He will give you every little desire of your heart. Now, what do you think the Apostle Paul would have said to something like that? What I'm saying here is, in essence, what they're teaching is there's no place in the life of a believer who's a true believer, who has the faith of a believer. There's no place in their life for suffering. What we should be saying, guys, is this: anathema, anathema. Like we talked about a couple of weeks ago. It is so unbiblical, it's not funny. A child in kindergarten ought to be able to demonstrate from the Bible that that is a false doctrine. It's a false belief. It's an untruth. Suffering, my friends, for the cross is part of being a Christian, and it's true for everybody, not just one or the other. Maybe some to a greater extent than others, but it comes with the turf. Sometimes to be laughed at, sometimes to be the brunt of somebody's joke, that you believe in the silliness that you do, the foolishness, the craziness. It's part of being a believer. It's what persecution is. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus said that. Not me.